See? And the singing of the Shira, right? The song of praise to God. And this is actually the first experience that the Jews have after the destruction of the Egyptians. So it says that Moshe led the people, led the Jews from the Yom Kippur, from the Red Sea, and they went to Midbar, it was called Midbar Shur, that's in the Sinai, and they went 3 days in the wilderness, in the desert, and they didn't find water. Okay? So then it says they came to Marah, a place called Marah, and they couldn't drink the water because of its bitterness. See, the word Marah means, from the Hebrew, means mar, bitter. The place was named because of the bitter water. See, Marah named because they were bitter. And therefore, its name was called Marah. Right, so it wasn't called Marah before they got there. It was named Marah, the place is known as Marah, because of the incident that occurred there, the bitter waters. Then it says that the people murmured, complained against Moshe, saying, "What shall we drink?" So Moshe cried out to God, and God showed him a tree. There's different ways to translate by Orehu. Instruct, that's another, yeah, because Orah, the term, right, from Orah, but not as everybody learns that way. The plain meaning is that God showed him a tree. But the Medrash, there's interpretations that say that you should read it the way you do, the way you just mentioned, that God taught him. That God taught him about a tree. But that's something to do with teaching. God communicated something over him. And he cast it into the water, and the waters became sweetened. So then the water was okay. Alright, then it says there he placed for him statutes and judgments. This is very, very complex, but, what he's talking about. And there he tested him. I mean, God tested him, referring to the Jewish people as one. So what does that mean? What does one thing have to do with another? Now, up till now, it's not that complex. Here it begins to get difficult. It seems pretty straightforward. Moshe led the Jews away from the Red Sea, and they traveled towards the desert. Okay. So it doesn't take long, and problems develop. Water. So it's in the desert that they made the preoccupation, obviously, with water. So they had water, but the water was bitter. They couldn't drink it. So they complained. Okay, they complained. So who'd they complain to? Moshe. So what does Moshe do? So Moshe cried out to God. And then it gets difficult. Then God shows him a tree. And he casts the tree into the water. And the water now is okay. Alright. So in other words, on a simple level, God performed a miracle for the Jews to give him water. And then it says he gave him statutes and teachings, ordinances, and very testament. So what does that mean? So let's continue. I'm sorry? So Rashi says that in Marah he gave them portions of the Torah because they were destined to receive the Torah at Sinai. They hadn't received the Torah yet. This is between leaving Egypt and between Sinai, which is a 49-day period. And as a result of this, God gave them certain portions of the Torah, revealed to them at this point. And Rashi says, in order that they should be immersed in them, they should get involved in them. Shabbos, the Parah Adumah, the red heifer, but what's pertaining to that, and demons, which means, laws that are governing damages and things, social laws pertaining to, societal laws. About damages and stealing and so forth. And there he tested him. We'll come back to that. But then he said, that's, we're in 26 now, if you will listen There's a big emphasis, like you see, that if listen, you will listen. Whenever the Torah repeats the word, it means to put emphasis on it. To the voice of the Lord your God, and that which is right in his eyes you will do, and you will listen to his commandments, and you will guard all of his statutes, then all of the illnesses that I placed on Egypt, I won't place on you, for I am the Lord your healer. It sounds like a threat. It sounds like a threat. So this is the episode then that I want to analyze tonight. And let's start with some questions. I'll give you that. In other words, what you preempted me, but basically I want to start off by saying, what did they do wrong here? In other words, the reaction of Moses needs to go beyond. It seems to be some, they need water. That's the realistic situation. They need water. So they don't have water. They're in the desert. So they complain. It doesn't seem to be that terrible a thing to do. On the surface, it's not. You've given a lengthy explanation of why it is, but that presupposes someone on a very, very high level. But, to start is, though, to start is what they did. I mean, we've read about worse things that the Jews have done in the wilderness, testing God with the golden calf, which is idolatry, and the sin of the spies, the refusal to fight and enter the land and do battle. They were afraid that they'd be destroyed. They didn't have faith that God could save them in war. So those are major kind of things. The thing that strikes me at first glance is that there's a very big reaction over here, as though something terrible has occurred. Where the story would have made sense to end would have been in like 25. So Moshe didn't really rebuke them. Moshe, they complained. So Moshe prayed. The expression, how do you have it translated? He cried, or he cried out to God? Is that the translation of 25? How do they translate it in English? Cried? Yeah, well, it means in prayer. It's a cry of prayer. So that's the expression that we use for prayer. When you're in a situation of distress, you cry out to God. And then God gave them a solution through the tree. And he cast them into the water, and the waters are sweetened. So now everything should be okay. But no. Then they get commandments. They get parts of the Torah. And then in 26, here's the first indication that something is amiss, because here they get a pretty stern rebuke. And an unmistakable warning. So my question for starters is, what did they do wrong here? What did they do wrong? That's one question. Now, basically, Laurie has said it. But there's more questions. I just want to, elucidate the question. Exactly. So, assuming then that, well, as Malki, as you say, that they should have been on a higher level and all of that, whether that's true or not, let's accept that for the time being. So what does it have to do with giving them, first of all, what does it have to do with giving them statutes and ordinances? Well, where do you get that from? You mean, in other words, what you're trying to explain 26. But I was going to ask the question. In other words, where does it come to that? What does that have to do with anything? That God is assuring them, well, actually it sounds like a threat, that if they will listen, if they will listen carefully, and they'll do that which is right in God's eyes, and they'll pay heed to his commandments, etc., then all of the illnesses that I brought on Egypt, I won't bring upon you. You're assuming now, well, why would they assume that they're next in line? What gives them... One thing, why would they assume they're next in line?
Because all of a sudden they're taking out and all of a sudden they find themselves...
Yeah, but they knew. They knew they weren't stupid people. They knew.
Why did he have to bring in the time?
That's that question. I just want to make clear. In other words, the question, I think, is stronger than the answer. The question is, the Jews weren't stupid. They knew why God had brought these plagues upon Egypt, because it's constantly being repeated that God had instructed Pharaoh to let the people go and serve God and so forth, and that if he refused, then God would bring afflictions upon them. And if they had any doubt, it seems, you're right, that they didn't have complete confidence. They had a confidence problem in spite of everything, there, because they were slaves. And they were afflicted by a slave mentality. And so that even after the Ten, when we read about it, it's very hard to read these, this is very difficult when we read these chapters of the Jews and the wilderness in general. Because we always put ourselves, yeah, we tend to put down the Jews, to belittle them, because we say, my goodness, if I'd have seen all of that, how could they possibly, after the splitting of the Red Sea and all that, how could there be room for doubt? The answer is, it's not, you know, I don't think we'd be any different, but it's not such a simple matter. Because, you see, even after the 10 plagues, when they saw the armies of Pharaoh charging against them, they panicked. They said, we were better off, you know, aren't there enough graves in Egypt? We'd be better off if we had stayed in Egypt. Then, after the splitting of the Red Sea, then they feared God, and they believed in God, they believed in Moshe. So now you would think that everything's going to be fine. But no, they go 3 days later in the wilderness, and they're having problems. But so they have a problem with the water. I really don't see why we would imagine that they thought that just because there's no water that God is going to do to them what he did to the Egyptians. That's like a big leap, if you ask me. Let's see if we can, you know, answer it without having to take it. I'm sorry, you want to go ahead, no? I'm going to try and work out here what the two things have in common. And also, what's the expression, I am the Lord your healer? Suddenly God is a... Right? Or no? Right? That's a second. And also, this is like, I don't know if I'll be able to answer this. I just like to state the question to God, but, you know, even if we can't answer tonight, maybe you'll think about it and we'll come up with something in the future. Is there any significance to the manner in which the waters were cured, so to speak? The casting, this whole thing about the tree obviously has significance. God showed him or taught him. Yeah, I mean, God, in the past, in other cases, Moshe, for example, by the splitting of the Red Sea, Moshe didn't throw anything into the waters. He just lifted up his staff. That's by the Red Sea. By the splitting of the sea. But over here, there must be some significance to the fact that the waters were cured through the... Yeah, but through the tree. And Moshe did it, right. What was the point of that? Okay. And good, Lord, to continue. And to resolve some of the questions. Now, Rashi says on Chafei, on the last part, there he established for him statutes and ordinances, and there he tested him. So, if you take a look at the second Rashi on that puppet, and there he tested him, the nation, and he saw their, literally their stiff neck, their heart, their stubbornness. What was their stubbornness? That they didn't consult with Moshe in a nice way. They didn't speak properly. And as you said before, in a dignified, civilized way. They should have come to him and to ask him to seek mercy for us, that we should have water to drink. But rather they murmured. So, in other words, they're not being rebuked for the fact that it was legitimate need. There was nothing wrong with that. It's a natural thing. People can't survive without water. So they went 3 days, and they didn't have water. So they're not being rebuked for the fact that they needed water. God did not expect them to be able to survive without water, or not to be affected by it, no matter what their level was. So what was so wrong? What was wrong was the way they reacted. They murmured, they complained, they grumbled, they were upset with Moshe. So let's try and understand that. So why is this a terrible thing? Oh, it's wrong. It's wrong. They should be dignified, they should be civilized, they should get together like people, and do it in a more respectable kind of a way. So they didn't. What's a terrible crime? The lack of civility? I mean, the civility, all right, it's a nice thing, it's important, but what does it indicate? Let's get down to something deeper over here. As a result of this, they got ordinances, they got laws, and they got this whole speech, and the threat, right, that if you don't watch it, it seems to indicate if you don't watch it, then all the plagues, and so forth. That seems to be the whole sin. Now, we're used to dealing with serious air issues, idolatry, as I said before, and rebelliousness, Korach. This seems to be, on the surface anyway, it's not that serious. So let's see if we can understand it on a deeper level. So the fact, what does that show us? The fact that they were not so proper, etiquette. They didn't follow etiquette over here. They were stubborn. This is where the expression, the stiff-necked people. Well, it says, it said openly, this is the Rashi. Yeah, I'm Sheherofata. You're a stiff-necked people. God rebukes them as being stiff-necked people. So that's not something that anti-Semite invented. That's from the Torah itself. That the Jews are a stubborn people. But that's good quality, too. It's not necessarily evil. We didn't survive all these years. In the world, being the way it is, we didn't survive all these years without a stiff neck. But it's got to be used for the right purpose. What we're saying is like this. On the one hand, the complaint was legitimate, but the way they expressed it was not proper, and this is regarded as being something serious. Why? What does that show you, psychologically? You have these situations... You have these situations often where a person... whether it's in, you know, human relations in school, whatever, and with children, where sometimes people come and they have all kinds of complaints that aren't reasonable. They're just not realistic or they're not true. But sometimes they have, what they're saying is legitimate. But the way they're breaking, the way they deal with their complaints tells you something. What does it tell you? Yeah. That's right. But sometimes they have to say like this, that they deserve better. That's good. That indicates something. The thing is like this, that sometimes a person gets distorted situation. In other words, they're unhappy or whatever it is, and so they make up complaints that just aren't real. That's one thing. But very often you'll encounter a situation where what a person is saying is true. He's complaining about something. He's not satisfied with something, and you look into it, and it's true. But the emotion that he exhibits is just not in line with the problem itself. In other words, it's an over-exaggeration. It's an overreaction. He's taking it on, like you'll have, like you said, like a student will complain, and you'll say, you're right, but what are you getting so crazy about? I mean, it's like the thing you're talking about. The emotion that you're exhibiting is not in line with the objective problem. It's incongruous with the, or incommensurate with the problem that you're talking about. You find that very, very often. That's a very subtle element in all kinds of relationships, whether it be children, husband, wife, this and that. You'll find that all of a sudden someone will start complaining about something, a whole list of things, and they're all true. And you think, well, what are you getting, it seems exaggerated. Now, when that occurs, what's happening over here? There's a psychological process going on. What's that psychological process? Yeah. In other words, when a person gets extremely angry, and they, in their own mind, associate it with something, which you know objectively is not that important, then you know that that's not really what's causing the emotion. It's what they call displacement. It's a displacement. There's something else that's bothering them. But they need an outlet. In other words, the person needs an outlet for something that's... He has a grievance. Now, since the person has a reality, each person operates with what he thinks he's in reality, right? So he can't get angry. Certain things he can't express. Certain things are bothering him, and he can't express them for certain reasons. Let's say he's angry at someone, but he can't express it. Or he can't express the true thing that's bothering him. So he waits. Then all of a sudden, something comes along that's legitimate, and then all the anger that he's been holding in comes out in that particular point. So he exaggerates the thing. When that occurs, you know that this is not what's bothering him. It's something else. And he himself may not be aware of it. Displacement. Right? In other words, so that's really where the sin, so to speak, of the Jews lies over here. The fact that they reacted this way and they didn't deal with the situation in a rational way. So there's a problem. We have a problem over here. In other words, if the problem really was the water per se, the realistic problem, you're going in the desert, we need water, the waters are bitter, it's a realistic situation, so they would have gotten together in a different way. They would have treated it realistically and said, well, what do we do now? But the fact that they started murmuring and complaining shows that something else troubled them. And they were just using this as an outlet. So what we have to discover is, what is it that was bothering them? What was the problem? What was their problem over there? And the only way we can get at it is by really, because it's not revealed to us directly, but through the reaction, through the way in which God deals with the situation and what God says to them, we can sort of deduce what it was that caused them. Let me also mention something else. This parsha over here, by the way, is the source for the law of reading the Torah publicly every 3 days. So we read the Torah on Shabbos, and Monday and Thursday it comes from this parsha. You know that? Moshe Rabbeinu. Yeah, it says they went 3 days. And this is, by the way, a clue to what's going on. This story is taken, has to be read on different levels, on the surface and behind the scenes. Everything here is alluding to something else. Because it says that they went 3 days in the water, they went 3 days in the wilderness without water. And water is always an alluding to Torah. Right? Water, the Torah is symbolized. So really, the rabbis say like this, what caused the problem? So they went 3 days without water. That means, on a different level, that they went 3 days without Torah. Now what happens when you go 3 days without Torah? You start to get grumbling, you start to complain. So therefore they instituted, Moshe did institute, this is a historical fact, the public reading of the Torah. Because the mitzvah to study, the mitzvah of Torah study is every day. But that's for the, in private, you know. But the formalized institution of Torah study, of reading the Torah, rather, whose purpose is Torah study, is on Shabbos. We read it on Shabbos, and then we read it again on Monday, so you don't have 3 days. And then we read it again on Thursday, and then on Shabbos again, so you never go 3 days without a Torah. At least it's read publicly. And that's the result of the situation over here. All right? Now, what's the underlying interpretation? What happened? Bear in mind also, I'll give you some more clues. Take a look at verse 22. What strikes you over here? Anything in the words? Nuances. I mean, you have to know the Hebrew. But the nuances. Vayasa Moshe at Israel.
Moshe
had to push them. That implies that there was a resistance. Return, in other words, the nature. And by Yesu, I found, by the way, the interpretation of Stanton Farrell Hirsch to be very, very helpful in this area. Well, especially with the words. He's excellent with the words. By Yesu, meaning they broke away. They broke away from something. So, what was their resistance? They had a certain resistance about leaving that place. What was the resistance? Yes? And that's what Hirsch says more about. Yeah. That's one, shot. But I would say also that this is really the beginning of the Exodus. The separation from Egypt takes place now. In other words, you mentioned the factor of security. Now, that's one of the most powerful drives that people have, is the need for security. Now, what was being tested over here was the satisfaction of their need for a sense of security. See, interestingly enough, it troubles us to read how often when they became very upset, they say, let's get a new leader and go back to Egypt. And we can't imagine, why would they want to go back to Egypt? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, a person can't live in a midbar. Why? Because a person needs a certain feeling of security. Now, he associates security with certain physical things, society. That's why people have to be in a civilization, have to be in society. They hate to go out into the woods. Because you're putting yourself in a situation, even though they had a bad situation, they were slaves. But still in all, they felt some security. They had the protection of the government if they did their work. So there was food supply. They knew that there was food. They knew they wouldn't starve. And there's always the fantasy that things might get better in the future. But they couldn't imagine leaving all sources of security and simply going into the wilderness. This was a tremendous test. This was the real Exodus. See, up until now, it's true they did leave Egypt, but they hadn't been in the wilderness yet. They left Egypt because of the 10 plagues. I mean, they didn't want to be slaves. Obviously, there were conflicting emotions. They certainly didn't want to be slaves. But you see that there was resistance. And then a tremendous change took place in the attitude of the Egyptians. And once they left, they were exposed to danger, so they panicked. But then they saw the tremendous salvation of the splitting of the Red Sea. They didn't want to go. And now going into the wilderness means to abandon all of the emotional sources of support that a person associates security with. What is there out there? There's nothing out there. There's no society. There's no what? There's no government. There's no food. There's no stores. There's no supplies. I mean, how are we going to function? So it meant that they had to give up all of the emotional bases that a person associates with security. That's, I believe, what bothered them. That's what troubled them. That they couldn't make that. That's why it says they went to the desert, and they went 3 days, and they didn't find water. See, the problem really wasn't the water per se, but water was just an indication that this is crazy. We're just going to get killed out here. There's no way that this can work, because it didn't conform to their own emotional needs. So that's why they murmured. That's why they complained. It meant, the complaining and the murmuring meant that they weren't content with the situation itself. With the situation itself. And they were just looking for an excuse to rebel against it somehow, to get out of the situation. Now, what was the solution? That was the problem. Now, what was the solution? You see, there's many different things over here. The rabbis indicate that they instituted the public reading of the Torah. That was the solution. Then God gave them commandments. Whatever they had. No, the prophets. Whatever they had. They had parts of the Torah.
Of course. Was it the prophets or
it wasn't. In other words. No, they added to it. Moshe. Started it. They expanded on it. Moshe started it. They had Torah. It wasn't the complete Torah. He gave them some laws here. But they had Torah, according to the tradition. They did have, right, the Torah from Abraham, from the fathers. They had the prophets. You know, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. You know, they had Torah. Now, so what does that do with it? What was the solution? I think that they were suffering from a state of dissatisfaction. In other words, it wasn't just it wasn't the water per se. As we said, the water triggered off something else. But they were discontent. If they weren't in a state of discontent, spiritually discontented, then, as we said, they would have reacted in an entirely different way. It's more than just, as I'm thinking, it's more than just the fact that they were frightened. There's the insecurity which we mentioned. I think it's also a certain amount of a letdown, a depression. That is to say, that there's no room for their fantasies in the wilderness. There's no fair person lives with certain fantasies. And these fantasies somehow keep them going. But now you're taken away. So the fantasies are associated. You're in society. So you see that there's wealth, there's this, there's entertainment. I mean, you know, you can get the same thing. If you work hard enough or whatever it is, there's something to look forward to. But they're being taken away from that, and they're being put into an entirely, completely different life. And they couldn't relate to that. They couldn't relate to that. So in other words, it's totally empty. It's bitter. The way of the Torah, you see, the way of the wilderness and following, living a completely different lifestyle, see, they were attuned, what they saw was the life of the Egyptians. That was the lifestyle. That was the lifestyle that they were looking for, or something similar to that. But the point of it is that, see, what Moshe realized, and what God did over here, the problem was that they were not involved in ideas. They were on an emotional level, and they weren't involved in ideas to give them satisfaction. See, the only way that a person could really be happy with the situation, you see, Moshe also didn't have water. Aaron also didn't have water. And by the way, it's not all the people there. It doesn't say, because later on, when it refers to the entire people, it mentions the entire congregation. Here it just means a significant portion of the people, but not everybody. In other words, people that were on a different plane were on an intellectual level, so they viewed the entire situation differently. So Moshe saw that the essential problem was that they were not involved in the world of ideas, in the world of knowledge. Now, so without the world of knowledge, So they just had the fantasy. And in this situation, in other words, as long as they were on the level of being involved in the emotional fantasy, so how can they survive in the wilderness? They just couldn't survive. So that's why Moshe began to institutionalize the reading of the Torah. Because he saw that on their own, they weren't inclined towards getting involved. He had to channel the emotion. But also, you see, God gave them mitzvot. God gave them mitzvot to be, as Rashi said, she'yis'asku behem. The mitzvot that God gave them to become involved. They needed to become involved in the intellectual life because this was an entirely different way of life. The satisfactions that they were going to have in this life, in other words, like this, when God took the Jews out of Egypt and God took them away from all of that, and God promised that he would give them the Torah, well, what was the point of it? It was because that is it for our, if God didn't give it us the Torah for his sake, we don't believe that the idea of serving God is because God needs our service. The entire point of the Torah is to enrich our lives. It's really for our betterment. It's to make us happy. So here these people are miserable. Now, there's a problem over there. There's a gap. In other words, there's a gap. And I think that each person, in a sense, experiences this gap. There's a wilderness that each person has to go through. It's interesting. I don't want to, like, be overly dramatic, but in the same way, I think we relive. Just like the Jews went from Egypt, from the enslavement, and they eventually wound up in the land of Israel to build the proper society, but they had to go through a wilderness. And in a certain sense, I think that each individual has to follow that same pattern in his life, where he goes from darkness, because we all start out as purely creatures of instinct and emotion and fantasies in our youth, right? We don't naturally desire truth and knowledge and understanding. That's not what we're drawn. So the way we're raised, we're all naturally inclined to certain emotional desires and fantasies. It's, of course, in our society, these things are reinforced, right? They're reinforced by the culture. But even if it wasn't, and this is every society basically has the same fantasies. So when a person discovers the truth, he has to pull away from that. Because he realizes that these things, that's the idea of Mitzrayim. The Makala, the illnesses of Egypt is the real, it's the ultimate failure of that lifestyle. When a person just lives that lifestyle, the lifestyle of the emotions, so at first it appears to him to be very attractive. And he doesn't see the problem. But if he just follows that way of life, then soon all the difficulties and the problems, and again, you can see it in America today. All right, now our attention is focused on the war in the Gulf, but before that, I mean, nothing but one social ill, drugs, I mean, nothing but after World War II, it was an era of tremendous materialism, right? The country was on a high, right? Economically, we were building up and expansion and tremendous breakthroughs in technology, and people thought it was like a golden age. And in the last 10, 15 years, I mean, all the problems that break with crime and new illnesses and the drugs and disease, the breakdown of the family unit, and tremendous problems in the whole society and discontent. I mean, there's never been a time when so many people have had psychological neuroses, and everybody goes to an analyst and social workers and psychologists, I mean, in the schools. You can't, the whole society, I mean, the truth of the matter, people with tremendous depression on the psychological level. It's not a happy time. It's not a happy year. The society is not really happy. Why is it? I mean, people, I just read an article, someone is wondering why we're so fantastic. Of course, they're performing so far anyway, the tremendous victories in the Gulf, and we're able to accomplish the task so with technology so accurately and so brilliantly. But when it comes to solving the problems at home, well, there's nothing but failure. There's such corruption in the society. In every area, even the religious leaders, the moral leaders, and the economics, with the deficit. I mean, after this war, you know, people aren't paying attention. After this is over, there's going to be a rude awakening. I mean, not that I'm not commenting on one way or another, as we've discussed it a little bit. I mean, it's certainly a good thing that a wicked ruler in a nation is being defeated and all that. But what particular benefit the United States hopes to get out of this and what the costs are going to be, that's going to be a rude awakening. But aside from that, you can't disguise the fact that there's something terribly wrong there. This is, American society represents the ultimate in living your dream, right? Your fantasy. This is the fantasy society. There's no question about it. No society in history has ever had the opportunity to satisfy its whims, every whim, the wealth, the opportunity, and it leads to failure. But you see, the Jews weren't capable of appreciating that. And the irony is, the tremendous irony is, that the way a person is constructed, the natural flow of his emotions and what he imagines to be the good is completely exactly the opposite of what the real good is. In other words, a person, right, we all wish, you know, may you have all of your dreams come true, you know, whatever you wish. That's what we always say to a person on a happy occasion. But it's not the truth, because if a person could satisfy all of his desires, he'd be miserable, he wouldn't be happy. It's not a nice thing to say to a person. You should have everything your heart. If you had everything your heart desired, you'd be the bosom of it. You wouldn't be happy at all, because the desires of your heart, and this is something that very few people can understand, the desires of your heart. All right, if a person is allowed to simply follow the natural desires of his heart, are not in line with his true needs and the real benefit of his soul, because a person is much more complex than that. And what if a man to be the desires that we feel, the emotion that stems from one part of us, our emotions, our instinctual makeup. But the human being is a very complicated instrument, and it's a very difficult thing to find happiness. And if a person just is allowed to be free, that's what a person feels like. He just wants to be free and follow all of his desires and obtain those desires. And nothing seems more opposed to that than the Midbar, than the wilderness. That's why when you tell a person about the Torah, it's very, very difficult. And that's precisely why the Jews, the famous statement of the rabbis that God offered the Torah to other nations, but they all turned it down. Only the Jews were willing to listen. Because the other nations, they had the fantasy. They couldn't imagine. The Torah, at first glance, seems to be taking you away from that. It's restraining you, it's restricting you. You can't do this, you can't do that. The sexual laws, the laws of the Sabbath, you can't, on Saturday, you can't do work, or you can't drive the car. And you have to be extremely careful, and you can't keep all your money, you have to give to charity, and you have to help other people, and their problems become your problems. All these things seem to be completely against our nature. But but the Jews, see, since the Jews were slaves, and they were cut off from satisfying their natural desires, so they were willing to listen, because they said, we're not going to get anything in this society, so they were willing to listen. Maybe there's a different way. See, a person, the time that a person is willing to listen is when to the Torah. When a person is going, when things are going well, he imagines that things are going well for him, and he's succeeding, and he's enjoying himself before the fall, he won't listen to Torah. He won't listen, because he thinks that this is the way to go. But then when people experience their downfall, and they're locked up in jail, and they can't have any of these satisfactions, so then they're willing to stop and consider, well, maybe there is a different, maybe I was wrong. That's not the real value. What my imagination told me to pursue. So that's what's happening over here. What God is teaching over here is that the happiness of a person is basically very, very, very far away from what he imagined it to be, and it's something which cannot be grasped by his emotions. What you're longing for emotionally is not what's really the good for you, and the only way you can relate to the good is through knowledge. And without knowledge, man is so constructed, there's so many problems, there's so many conflicts, by his nature, he's just riven with conflict. Any area of your life, you'll see. Even if you, a person becomes wealthy, it only creates more conflicts, because then she wants to get a house, but then she get it this, you get it that way, and the decorations, and this and that, and choice, I could have this, maybe I could have that. Nothing but conflicts, but then in every area that he's involved in, the relationships, he falls in love, but then there's other problems, and I have the emotion, but then I'm not satisfied with the way, with the values, and in every area. There's no area in this world that a person can escape from. And therefore, God gave us a Torah. That's exactly what, and that's how man is different than all the animals. All the other animals find their happiness simply by following their instincts. God programmed their own objective, their purpose, into their instinctual makeup. But a man cannot find happiness by following his instincts. He has to know, because he's too complex. He's a combination of, on the instinctual on the one hand, he's got a soul, a divine soul, the capacity for knowledge and understanding. And this new creature, this new creation, this combination is too complex. And that's why he has to have knowledge. But you see, that goes against, he still resists. He has a certain stubbornness. That's the kshiara. That stubbornness was, they wouldn't relinquish their own natural idea of what's right. And that's the conflict that each person faces. To give up his own natural idea, his emotional idea of what's right, and to approach it from a purely rational point of view, what is mind, to follow the life that's dictated by the mind. And, of course, to do so, you have to go through the experience of the wilderness. There's going to be a gap. In other words, when a person begins to change his way of life, see, he is giving up the satisfactions that he's been accustomed to, and he has not yet arrived at the stage where he's capable of substituting them with the new satisfactions. That's the wilderness. I'll give you a very rough analogy. It's, for example, a person, let's say he wants to learn how to ski. Let's take any complicated activity. But let's use that for our analogy. Because it looks like a lot of fun. He puts on a CV and he sees these people jumping off and going down, and this looks like tremendous fun. So he says, well, I'd like to do that myself. It looks like fun to be able to go. I like ice skating. That looks like a lot of fun, right? You go out there at night in Central Park and you're skating around. It looks like a lot of fun. So what do? So you go out to the Central Park. We switch now. We're doing ice skating. The skiing gets all the way out the mountains. Hey, you go to Central Park. It's quicker. So it looks like fun. You see these people sliding around and turning around in the middle and jumping. It looks like a lot of fun. So you put the skates on. You go out there. Plop. You try to move this. It's not. Now, most people will just, too much pain. They'll give up. But if a person has that, they'll realize, look, those people can do it, I could do it too, but it takes training and this and that, and you have to use your mind. And you can't just follow your natural instinct. What you'll do naturally, any training will tell you it's not going to work, but you have to do other things. Why am I doing those things? Well, don't ask why, this is what you have to do. Now, in that stage, the person is basically in the wilderness. Because he's not, he could be home watching TV, so he decided he's tired of being a couch potato. He wants to get and do something. But at least when he watched TV, he got some satisfaction. But now he doesn't have any satisfaction, right? And the only reason he's doing it is because he knows he's following his mind. He knows that at the end of all this pain, there's going to be a much greater pleasure than the pleasure he had before. See, that's the wilderness. But not everybody can do it. And this, of course, that's the example I gave you is much simpler. That's within the realm of a physical pleasure. So a person can imagine the physical pleasure of ice skating. Even though he hasn't done it, he can watch, he can identify with it. But to imagine a completely different way of life, a totally different lifestyle, that you just can't eat the things that you're naturally accustomed or desire to eat, and you just don't do what you feel like doing, and you've got to discipline yourself, and you have to govern yourself, and you have to redirect your energies to take them away from all of these, the world of the imagination, and all these fantasies, and to redirect that into a life which is filled with study and with knowledge and understanding. But ultimately, that type of a life and that type of an experience is much more joyful than what you imagined, what you wanted. That's a tremendous transformation. And this is what they were suffering from, I believe, over here. That sure was the water, the bitterness, yeah, in the middle of that water. Yeah, but it doesn't say one second. Hold on. It doesn't say that they were dying of thirst. It doesn't say that. It didn't say they didn't drink in 3 days. They didn't see any water. They may have had. No. No one is saying is they went 3 days without drinking. It says they didn't see any water supplies. So what were they worried about? Meanwhile, God will take care of it. They were looking. They didn't like the situation. It wasn't something, it didn't fit into their imagination. That's not what we thought it would be like. It's not the way we envisioned it. Of course, they were told about a land which flows milk and honey. In the end, there'd be milk and honey. But at this stage of the game, there was, and they didn't see anything. You see? Now, I think, I start to worry, 1 second, what kind of a place is this? I mean, my water supply is getting... No one is denying that they needed water. Now, what I mean to say is, of course, their water supply was running low. They needed water. It's a realistic problem. But they didn't approach it realistically. There was no need for this panic. There was no need. God had taken care of them until now. There was no need to panic. You know what I'm saying? The panic...
No,
it doesn't say. It doesn't say that it was bitter, but he's just saying in reality a tree is not sweet. A tree is not, you know, the bark is bitter and so forth. Yeah, the Rebbe Chazal say that. It's not his own idea. Yeah, you think, or it didn't take. No, you would think it was something called sugar cane, something sweet. Right. Something sweet, but God deliberately took something which wasn't sweet. To sweeten it. To sweeten the water. The sweetening of the water. I would say like this, let me just state my idea. Algae over here, that the idea of the sweetening of the waters, it reminds me of what the rabbis say. That it says the Rishayim, the wicked people, their beginning is sweet, but their end is bitter. When they start out it's very sweet. But the end is bitter. And the righteous, the beginning is bitter, but the end is sweet. Which means, because for the wicked, it starts off, they're very happy. They're just fulfilling all their... But for the righteous, it starts out being bitter. Because he's not giving in to his natural inclinations. He's controlling himself. He's studying the situation. He's using his mind. He's changing himself. He has to go through a transformation. So it's very bitter. It's painful. There's a lot of conflict. But in the end... there's harmony. Everything works out harmoniously because man is designed to live harmoniously, provided he follows
the order
that God has decreed for him. Because God is his creator, God knows his soul, and that's the idea, I believe, of the sweetening of the waters. See, it starts off; it appears to you to be very bitter. The waters are bitter. Right? That's no question about it. That's the problem. The waters are bitter. The waters have to be sweetened. So you would, how would you sweeten it? You would take sugar. And man, by the human being, starts off unhappy by nature. He's unhappy. He's got a void. He's in a state of spiritual need, and you want to fill that void. And how do you imagine to do so? By sweet, pleasant things, pleasant experiences, all of the emotional fantasies that you have. The answer is no. No, it can't. It's got to be. See, but with the tree, is bitter. You've got to follow knowledge. And therefore you take something which goes completely against your grain. It's not in line. Happiness is not to be found by going in line with the natural grain. You've got to submit yourself to a superior wisdom over here. And that's why, for example, he gave him, interesting, Choku Mishpat. Now Mishpat are those parts of the Torah which appeal to human reason, right? Which we would legislate on our own, basically. The laws that you have in any society. Of course, the way the Torah structures them is different, but the laws themselves are in line with human rationality. Choke, Rashi says, what's of the statutes? The statutes, he says, are those laws that the person rebels against. And he says that the evil inclination complains about them. Like the laws of Chatenay, right? And other laws. Because we don't understand, of course they have a rationality, but the reason is not immediately apparent to us. The reason, many of the laws in the Torah, the reasons of our parents, to honor thy father and mother. That makes sense to us, right? And to help the poor. That's appealing to us. It makes sense to us. And many other laws in the Torah. But then the laws of the Torah don't make any sense to us. And therefore we say, what do we need these laws for? The Torah legislates about a lot of things. As he said, that you mixing of wool and linen together within one garment. And these things don't make sense to us on the surface. And then other laws like that. Because there it's the suppression of the human ego to recognize that we live in the framework of a world, and there's a which is the creation of a creator. I mean, and we can't question his wisdom. I am the Lord your healer. You have to know, just like you go to a doctor, the knowledge of a doctor is of course much greater than yours. And of course you'd like to understand, to the extent that you can understand, it's good. But when he gives you a medication, you know, and let's say you can't understand it because it's beyond your ability. You have to be very sophisticated. You'll do it. Why would you do it? It doesn't make sense to me. If he'll prescribe something, and very often, you know, the prescriptions are things which make no sense to you, and you can't see how one thing relates to another. But you do it because you're living the life of reason. And the person who's living the life of reason, his barometer is not how he feels about something, but the barometer is what his mind tells him to be rational. That's the way a person is. That's what I believe. That's what God is telling him. That's why it brings in the that last verse over here, which sums it all up. That if you will listen to the voice of God, which means that you recognize that you're not listening to your own voice. Each person wants to listen to his own voice. He's got a voice inside of him telling him what to do, telling him where he should go. You put that voice aside and you recognize that you've got to submit to the voice of God. Then it says, Vayosher be'enav, and that which is right in his eyes. Yeah, because each person has a sense of right and wrong. Everybody knows exactly what's right. I know what's right. Yeah, there's a certain sense. Well, how do you know it's right? Because if I feel this way, I know it's only right. And that's why 90% of all these squabbles people out, the fight people out. He didn't do this, and what's wrong in this situation, you should have called me, or you should have done this, and that's right. But how do you know it's right? That's why, you know, that's where I was raised. And I was raised properly, and that's the way. In other words, each person is so convinced. And that's why you have all this strife in society. Because the other person is equally convinced that his way is right. And neither one is objective. So the only way is by Yosha be'enav. Sure, you want to do what's right. But you have to realize that what you feel, your emotions dictate as being right. That's just a feeling. The only objective system of right and wrong is that which is given to you by God. And Vazanto and Mitzvoto. And you will listen carefully to gain. Rashi says that you will turn your ears to become involved in understanding them carefully. And guard all of his statutes. See, if you live that lifestyle, then you'll be saved from the diseases which befell the Egyptians. Because the diseases which befell the Egyptians and all the sufferings that they had, don't think it's just because of an accident, then you'll be different. You study all the different great societies, civilizations, Rome and Greece, and all these empires, and there was, everyone was the most mighty in its time, and all of them came crashing down. It's not just extraneous circumstances, it's because of the whole system is not there. The underlying philosophy, the underlying approach, because at bottom they were motivated by the same thing. They may have been sophisticated in science and technology, but at bottom their value system was not a value system of truth. So it's basically follow the natural human emotions. But they were smart. They knew that to satisfy your emotions, you have to know how to use science, you have to know how to use technology. But if the underlying motivation is that infantile desire to satisfy the strivings of the heart, then it's going to lead to nothing but pain. All the pains. And that's why Egypt fell apart. The Egypt thing that typifies that society which is living that lifestyle. If you'll pull yourself away from that, then you will be spared, because I am the Lord your healer. I know your nature. In other words, each person is really in need of healing. The way he's created, a man is not a harmonious creature by nature. He's very disharmonious, whatever the word is. Yeah, disharmonious by nature. We're not harmonious. It's very rare to find a happy person. But it's even rarer to find a naturally happy person. Well, everybody strives for that. You know, you meet somebody, a person who's happy, who's content with himself, who seems to flow smoothly, everything goes nicely. So we admire that, because everybody would love to be that way. Well, first of all, it may not be that simple. And a lot of people are very good at putting on a face for society. It's not the way it appears, because I don't believe it's not life is too complex. But you will find very, very rarely someone who's just naturally happy, whose emotions are such. They're very fortunate. Yeah. You see, they had this article about certain people. Yeah. They're looking for their happiness pill. The outside is basically, it's an admission. They're looking for the happiness pill. That's why all these different fads every day. It's a new, not to, you know, but there's a new diet or a new this. Right. Every, and it's more. Fit for life. It's exercise or it's a diet thing or it's a, another discovery. Another gene. They'll discover another gene. In this case, there's something about the brain. One side of the brain. It's a fantasy. See, because, but it's an admission. It's an admission that we haven't found that yet. But the way to, see, they're looking for a pill. A certain, they want to use like a certain magical pill. We'll give it to us. It's a fantasy. But God is saying, I am your healer. Just like a Dr. Rashi says. Just like a doctor knows what you need and how to prevent illness. I mean, a good doctor is not just one who can cure you when you become sick, but the real good doctor is the one who can prescribe a regimen for you so that you won't become sick in the first place. But here we're talking about the, as someone quoted the Sforno before, David, I think it was you, yeah, that's the mitzvah. This is not, we're not talking here with physical. We're not talking about physical. Don't get the wrong impression. When you first read, you can get the wrong impression that the purpose of keeping the mitzvot in the Torah is that it's going to keep you physically healthy. That is not the purpose. That's not, it's not a cure for physical ills. Of course, if you leave the Torah life, you'll have a much better physical life because her ways are ways of pleasantness. But that's not what we're talking about. It's really the illnesses of the soul. And that's the real destruction. A person is really destroyed not so much because of the physical. And we know today, we do know the extent to which the spiritual or the psychological unhappiness does affect the physical. But the prime meaning over here is that you're basically in need of healing. You're all in need of healing. And that's why everybody's searching. And the answer is to be found in that which where you least expect it. Because in that system, which goes completely against your emotions, which is the wilderness, and that's the challenge. Each person has to be able to face the wilderness. And a person that either makes them or breaks them, that's the tremendous challenge. And that's the confrontation. That the Jews have to go through the wilderness, and I believe that each person has his own wilderness. And the wilderness is that situation where you have that emotional conflict. And where you can't, you have to give up something which you desire. And all of your feelings tell you that this is the good. How can I live without this? There's no way I can live without this. But when you study the matter carefully, that's free will. That's where free will comes in. There's two pictures. Your emotion gives you one picture, but logic and reason and knowledge tells you that that's no good. And then you have to choose. So that's the, I think this is the basic underlying. Of course, there's many more particulars we can go into, but the basic underlying idea of the story here. Well, you want to say something?